Hello, this is Anil Kumar, and thanks for joining us for Back to the Bible radio broadcast. Today, in our current series, Life Lessons from David, the man who would be king, Dr. Neufeld walks us through a pivotal moment in David's life recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 29 in today's message, Seeing God Act When We Have Failed. Let's go back to the Bible with Dr. John Neufeld.
Every man or woman who lives a life filled with significance and meaning has struggled with moments in which it seemed like everything is now ruined. When Jesus was nailed to a cross, that's what his followers surely thought. And we, unlike Jesus, will find that often it is our own sins, our own mistakes and failures, our own short-sighted solutions to the problems that we face that militate against a life of significance. But David's life reminds us that when the call of God is on our lives, even our greatest mistakes and sins cannot keep us from the destiny God has ordained for us. Ephesians 1:4, chosen before the foundations of the world. Well, 1 Samuel chapter 27 represented a near cataclysm in David's life. We've seen how David, discouraged and fearful because of Saul's repeated attempts on his life in moments of despair, reasons that Saul is going to get him. 1 Samuel 27 verse 1 began, Then David said in his heart, Now I shall perish one day by the hand of Saul. It is that narrative that kept going on in David's mind. Even though God had saved him in the past, Saul, he thought, is going to get me one day. And so David made his way to one of the five royal cities of the Philistines, the enemies of Israel. There he sought refuge in Gath, the city of Goliath, and there he put himself under the protection of King Achish of Gath. And even though David managed a situation where he would live out of the eyesight of Gath and of King Achish, he was forced to lie to Achish regularly. He tells him he's been raiding Jewish settlements when he's been doing nothing of the kind at all. He's leading a double life. And just like what happens to all people who lead double lives, eventually there's a price to pay. Yesterday, as we studied 1 Samuel 28, David's double life comes to the forefront. A massive war is on the horizon between Israel and Philistia. Let's reread 1 Samuel 28, verse 1. In those days, the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. And Achish said to David, Understand that you and your men are to go with me in the army. And of course, David agrees. And then amazingly, Achish adds one more word. I will make you my bodyguard for life. And with those words, David's freedom to do as he pleases in his city of Ziklag comes to an end. He is permanently assigned to a king who is, in fact, a warlord committed to the destruction of Israel. Now, before the writer of 1 Samuel allows us to ponder this change of events, we are taken from that scene to the tragic and pathetic picture of King Saul of Israel, alienated from his God, consulting with a medium. But when Saul's pathos-ridden scene has been played out before us, the author of 1 Samuel takes us back to David. Let's read 1 Samuel 29, verse 1. Now the Philistines had gathered all their forces at Aphek, and the Israelites were encamped by the spring that is in Jezreel. Now stop here for a moment and notice how the account is arranged. In chapter 28, the Philistines were pictured as being encamped in a place called Shunem, and in the next chapter, they're pictured as encamped in a place called Aphek. Now the reason for the difference is that chapter 29 contains a bit of a flashback. In chapter 28, the Philistines are at Shunem. Now, Shunem was the base camp or the place where the lines were drawn up for battle. It is located in the region of Galilee on the plains of Megiddo, Armageddon, or the Valley of Jezreel. If the Philistines win this battle, they will control the major trade route connecting Egypt in the south to Mesopotamia in the north. This is a battle over who controls the trade and therefore money and power in Canaan. This is no minor skirmish. This is all-out war for the future of the region. Now in chapter 29, that is in the next chapter, the Philistines, however, are in Aphek, about 50 kilometers to the south of the battlefield. That is why we know that chapter 29 is a flashback. Before the battle at Mount Gilboa took place, when the Philistine forces were preparing for their march to the battlefield, they gathered all their forces at Aphek. Now, verses 2 and 3. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" Now we remember from our study of 1 Samuel that the Philistines had five key cities and that each city had its own king and their own military commanders. And so in order to organize into a fight, the Philistines had to coordinate their efforts. David has been made Achish's personal bodyguard, hence he will hold a key place on the field of battle. But as they're organizing, because Philistia doesn't operate under a single command structure, an argument ensues. Why would you take Hebrews to war against their countrymen? Now, no doubt they're thinking about the Battle of Michmash, which was recorded in 1 Samuel chapter 14. You may remember that Jonathan's courage in that battle turned the tide in favor of Israel, so that 1 Samuel 14:21 says, "Now the Hebrews who had been with the Philistines before that time, and who had gone up with them into the camp, even they also turned to be with the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan." Now, you can only imagine the chaos in the Philistine camp as they were having trouble figuring out who was for or who was against them. And that battle, as you know, turned out to be an unmitigated disaster for the Philistines. The Philistines did not want to repeat that. And so as they're trying to organize, an argument ensues about what to do with David and his 600 trained fighting men, all Hebrews. Well, let's keep reading, verses 3 to 5. And Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of Saul, king of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years, since he has deserted to me, and I have found no fault in him to this day?" But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, that he may return to the place to which you have assigned him. He shall not go with us to battle, lest in the battle he become an adversary to us. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is not this David, of whom they sang to one another in dances, 'Saul has struck down his thousands, and David his 10,000s?'" You know, I'm struck by two outstanding features in this dialogue. The first is that Achish is completely convinced that he has no better friend than David. He has believed David when David told him that he was raiding the Hebrews and stealing their property. But in truth, as we have seen, he has been raiding the enemies of Israel and killing all of them, protecting Israel. David has been lying to Achish with such consistency and so convincingly that Achish is ready to go to battle and to entrust his life into David's hands. What he doesn't know is that David is a deceiver. Now, when I think about this, I think of the two kings that David has served under. The first is Saul, and Saul was convinced that David was trying to overthrow him and take away his kingship, even murder his family. But David was completely loyal to Saul. And the second king is Achish, who believes David is completely loyal to him. But in fact, David would likely have killed him the minute the battle was engaged. What kind of a man is David becoming? Who can trust him now? You know, the second feature of the dialogue in question is the rejection of the Philistine military commanders of David as an act of God. Exactly how would David's men have reacted when they first marched out onto the battlefield and looked across the line to see their brothers on the other side with the banners of the armies of Israel unfurled? Had David not in earlier years been enraged when Goliath had mocked the armies of the God of Israel? How would it have felt as he stood facing the armies of God and hearing the taunts and curses against them and God from his own side of the battle? Would some of the others' side have recognized David? And what would that have meant for David's future as a possible king for Israel? I love what one Bible teacher said. Having foolishly sought salvation through the Philistines, he now needed to be saved from his friendship with the Philistines. Well said. As long as there was no major war between Israel and Philistia, David's duplicitous double life would never be discovered. But once the inevitable happened, he would be exposed. David's dilemma reminds me that it simply is not possible to live in two worlds forever. You can't pretend loyalty to Philistia and secretly be loyal to God. Eventually, you will be exposed, and eventually your double life will be reason for shame. I'm reminded of Paul's teaching in Ephesians 4:25. "Therefore, having put away falsehood, let each one of you speak the truth to his neighbor." Or in 1 Timothy 6:13 and 14, "I charge you in the presence of God to keep the command unstained and free from reproach until the appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ." You know, this idea of being like Christ, unstained and free of reproach, is the idea that when anyone discovers the truth about our lives, we are not ashamed. That is, who we are and who we appear to be, that both are the same. And at this point, David's life is not like this at all. Saul is about to consult a medium and be rejected by God and killed on the battlefield, and David is about to leave Ziklag and go to Hebron and join Israel again. But as David gets set to be king, he looks so compromised.
Just when it appears that David has found a safe haven in enemy territory under the protection of a Philistine king, we see that his deceitful life is catching up to him. Indeed, this is a sobering reminder that we can never truly get away with our sins before they become exposed. But even when we have utterly failed, there is always hope when we turn to God. Join us again as Dr. Neufeld helps us understand the real implications for our own journey, whatever you have been through. Back to the Bible, leading people into a dynamic relationship with God. The Bible contains many passages about the topic of wisdom. Here are a few examples. James chapter 1 verse 5 says, "If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him." Or how about Ecclesiastes chapter 7 verse 12 says, "For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it." Wisdom is a critically important issue for all believers to understand and apply it. Hopefully, you have had a chance to listen to Dr. Neufeld's recent series on the subject called Skillful Living, focusing on Proverbs, known as wisdom literature. We learned all about what it means to live a wise and godly life. This great series is available on CD for our valuable listeners. To receive it, call us at 9492-440070 or email at info@backtothebible.in.